Scott Weinberg is a veteran film critic. Steven DeGennaro is a doctor of astrophysics. Listen in as these two nerds compare and contrast two noteworthy sci-fi films every week. They'll discuss the artistic quality of the films, whether they get the science right, and whether or not that even matters. Welcome to Science vs. Fiction.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Science vs. Fiction, the show in which a film critic and an astrophysicist discuss two films in the realms of quality entertainment and scientific intelligence. As always, I am joined by my co-host, the intelligent Dr. Steven DeGennaro, the former astrophysicist. How are you, Steve?
I am good.
Why don't you tell our listeners what we are here to talk about for our Christmas holiday New Year's episode?
I mean, can there be anything other than Gremlins?
Yeah.
The greatest Christmas movie ever made?
At least in the realm of like family-friendly but slightly harsh sci-fi horror comedy. I love it.
Of all of that kind of movie,
yeah,
this is the best one.
I mean, but that's my favorite kind of movie, Steven, is multi-genre. The stuff that Carpenter and Dante and Spielberg are so good at is a horror movie, it is a comedy, it is sci-fi, and it is kind of like a great homage to alien invasion movies from the 1950s.
And it's also a thoroughly, thoroughly Christmas movie.
I know, and it does add a very seasonal, homey, quaint kind of, reminds me of like kind of a dark parody of It's a Wonderful Life, and that's part of the Christmas angle, I think. Which was written by Chris Columbus back in the day before he had become mega director Chris Columbus. He had written this and The Goonies.
This was supposedly a spec script that he never intended to sell, that he, you know, wrote to show that he was capable of writing. And Steven Spielberg read it and was like, holy crap, this is like the most original thing I've ever read. I want to buy it and make it.
Yep. And I believe we've talked about it before, and we will talk about it again, how Joe Dante is, without question, one of my very favorite directors. His track record in my nerd book is aces, A+. I don't love all his movies, but I like all of his movies, all of them. And I just think he has a real movie love, a real genre. He loves old sci-fi fantasy horror. He winks at the audience. He's letting you in on the jokes in films like The Howling and, of course, Gremlins and Innerspace. He's very inclusive, fun, amiable films. And sometime in the future, I would love to pair up Fantastic Voyage with Innerspace because they're both about scientists who get shrunk down and put into somebody's bloodstream. But let's talk about Gremlins. Steven, did you love this one as a kid or did you come to this fresh? What's the story?
So I was thinking about this afternoon. I do not remember the first time I saw this movie. I have no recollection of it. I remember very specifically being at my friend Dan's house and his dad was going to take us to the movies in the summer of 1984. And we had a choice to go see this or to go see Ghostbusters. And, you know, for our cohort at 7 years old at the time, Ghostbusters was, you know, the big thing you had to see. And so we went to go see Ghostbusters instead of this. And, you know, I certainly don't regret that decision, but I got to see Ghostbusters in the theater. I'm pretty sure I did not ever then get to see this in the theater, but I don't have any recollection of where or when. I probably caught it on TV at some point because as it endlessly replayed around Christmas time at a cousin's house or something like that. But I can't really remember a time when I hadn't seen this movie. And I can't remember the first time I saw it, and I've probably seen it, you know, a couple dozen times at this point. So
I'm glad that you brought up that it was released on the same day as Ghostbusters. Imagine that quandary, movie nerds. Friday night, and you and your friends or your wife or your husband, whatever you may have next to you, says, let's go see a movie. Oh, I would like to see Ghostbusters. I would like to see Gremlins. I bet there were divorces that happened over that argument.
Why not both?
Why not both? I distinctly remember seeing both in theater, but I cannot remember which one I chose to see first, unfortunately. I absolutely loved both. And the beautiful thing about both movies is that, in my opinion, I honestly believe that both of these movies really hold up. I think Gremlins is as fun as it was when I was young. And that is a real compliment to everybody, from Spielberg to Columbus to Dante, the cast and crew, to Chris Wallace, who designed the Gremlins. And I mean, it is just fun.
Jerry Goldsmith,
that score is such fun. It has that.
So iconic.
Yeah. It has that one little playful hook that. But beyond that, when it gets creepy and when it gets playful, that's the whole score is great. And it also has other historical footnotes. It was along with Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, one of the two films that was most responsible for creating the PG-13. The plot, a young man gets a brand new animal for a pet from his beloved dad. And we'll talk in a minute about him. I love Hoyt Axton in this movie. What a great,
yeah. Oh, he's so
great,
good.
Great movie dad. Best known as a country western singer, with us no longer, but he became an actor as well. And it's easy to see why, because he's got that great warmth to him. And I think that anybody who remembers Gremlins loves the dad. Love Hoyt Axton.
Yeah.
So his dad wants to get his son a unique gift for Christmas. So he gets him this very rare animal called a Mogwai, which is the adorable Gizmo, who everybody knows and loves. And he brings him home, and there are three distinct rules. Steven, do you want to rattle off the rules?
The rules are he does not like bright light, and sunlight will kill him.
Yep.
The second rule is you can't get him wet.
Correct.
And the third rule is that you cannot feed him after midnight.
Right.
And, you know, when he tells him these rules, he conveniently leaves out what happens when you do all of these things or what the consequences will be.
That is a good point. And we will get into the science of these rules. And I do want to stipulate right now, I don't want to 100% speak for Steven. We like this movie. So if we're going to get a little bit nitpicky, it's all tongue-in-cheek when we get to the rules and the science of this movie, because it is more fantasy than science fiction. Nobody is claiming that Gremlins is meant to be round in any kind of real biology. We're just having fun here.
It's fascinating to talk about.
Absolutely.
I want to just get into it, to be honest with you.
All right. You know. Well, anyway, the plot, everybody knows the plot. The adorable monster gets wet, and more adorable monsters are born, but they're a little bit stupider. They eat food, turn into gremlins.
And meaner.
Meaner, yes, thank you. Fall into a swimming pool in a great sequence, and then they multiply exponentially because you're not supposed to get them wet. So then this small town of Kingston Falls is overwhelmed by an army of skittering little green monsters, and they are both wacky funny in a Three Stooges way, and then sometimes legitimately intimidating and dangerous. And I think that balance is what makes the film so damn fun.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is a horror, it's the rare horror comedy that is both creepy and tense and scary in places, but also extremely funny and often at the same time. And that to me is, you know, or within the same very small time span, it can turn on a dime from being funny to being, you know, scary as hell, I'm sure, if you're seven when you see it the first time.
So. To me, that's one of Joe Dante's strongest assets, is that he can be playfully dark. That's the key. You know, it's not too morbid to make you go, ugh. But it's, you know, there are characters being killed in like, you know, I could see how maybe Tim Burton was partially inspired by the sensibility of Joe Dante in this kind of playfully dark way.
It's kind of a miracle that it got made, because you can see a version of this. I feel like if they remade this today, they would do it much more like a Home Alone sort of straight comedy kind of thing where, you know, the in some sense, honestly, kind of like the sequel where the, you know, although the sequel did not pare down the gruesomeness really all that much, but I can see them sort of scaling back a lot of the more gruesome moments. I can't imagine you have the moment with the blender or with the microwave or with the dog tied up.
Yep.
In a modern version of this movie.
Yeah, and again, you nailed it. That's what makes it so fun. It's almost like dancing. It's like dark, take three steps dark, four steps comedy, three steps dark, you know, and it's like a good director and a good editor and a good writer. That's what it takes to balance the horror and the comedy so that it doesn't get too wacky and therefore the scares don't work. Or if it's too brutal, then you don't want to laugh anymore.
Right.
All right, Steven, let's go back to the rules.
Okay.
Don't get them wet. How realistic is not getting a creature wet at all on a planet that is mostly moisture?
I don't know. You can ask the aliens from Signs. See how well it worked for them.
Okay, fair enough. But is there not moisture in the air around my face right now?
When I walked out of the house this morning to bring the kids to school, my car was covered with dew.
Okay, but if Gizmo stays in the house all the time and never leaves, it's feasible that moisture would not get on him at all, right? No.
Well, again, there's moisture. The air has moisture in it.
So I'm getting wet just sitting here.
It's really tough. So I will say this. I had, you know, having watched both of the movies back to back yesterday and this morning, there's a scene, jumping ahead a bit here, but there's a scene in Gremlins 2 where the goofy gremlin is in a stew pot and seems to be not multiplying at all. So he's in this big pot full of stew and vegetables and cabbage and whatever the heck else is in it. And clearly a lot of water because it's stew. And that doesn't seem to actually be causing him to reproduce. But then they turn on the, they stick some stuff in the microwave. They start a fire that turns on the sprinklers. And as soon as the sprinklers start hitting him on the head, now suddenly he starts reproducing. And so I guess maybe, like, if you want to take that as canon, and if you want to take, the literal interpretation of this, I suppose you could argue that it has to be pure water, and there has to be a sufficient amount of it, and so there's not enough in the air to make them multiply. I mean, it certainly implies in both in the first movie and in the second movie that the more water, the more offspring, right? Because when it jumps in
right,
the pool,
right? But that then the swimming pool sequence makes no sense because they would create a whole lot more than could just fill a movie theater. They would like 100,000. They would be exponentially.
Well, larger. So here's the other big question from a scientific point of view about this reproductive method, right?
Go.
So he gets a little bit of water dripped on his back, basically. Corey Feldman knocks over a cup of water and it spills on him. And he starts freaking out, and these little fur balls pop off. And within a few seconds, these things are the same size as him, meaning there's now, I think 5 of them come off of him. And so there's now, 6 of them where there was previously 1. They're all about the same size, which means they're all about the same mass, which means where did all of that extra mass come from? They didn't eat anything. There wasn't enough water there to actually turn them, to have turned the water physically into other things. So the swimming pool, I suppose, there's a physical limit, right, to how many of them you could physically fit in the swimming pool. So at some point, all of the water would be gone because they would have splashed it all out or turned it all into other gremlins. And they're physically, like, the size of the swimming pool dictates how many gremlins you could possibly reproduce.
Good point. Or another theory from Dr. Weinberg. Here's one. Maybe each individual gremlin can only reproduce once within a certain period of time. So once it hits the water, it pops out 5 or 6 more, and those newborns can't reproduce. And the other one would have to, get out of the water and maybe wait 12 hours to reproduce
well,
again.
Certainly within, it's never established in either movie what the time scale is, like how old they have to be, how long it takes them to reach sexual maturity is how you would refer to it to a normal animal.
How did that not make it into the script?
But, right, so, but they reproduce fairly quickly shortly after they're born. So there's nothing to indicate that, like, if, you dropped one in a swimming pool and it had 5 babies, that those 5 babies wouldn't immediately. In fact, that scene implies that that's exactly what happens, that clearly, it's not. He doesn't just have 5 babies. Those babies must have babies too, because there's in very short order, there's enough to fill a movie theater. So, I think it's just physically
right. But to fill a movie theater,
I would say that the number required to fill a movie theater is probably roughly the same as the amount as you could imagine fitting in the swimming pool comfortably before they had to get out and were like, all right, we're done.
I wonder if anybody who worked on this movie discussed it this much in detail.
All right. So the next rule,
they don't like bright light, and sunlight can kill them. This one is, I'm gonna guess before I go over to you, the most scientifically logical of the 3 rules.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, so number one, they have gigantic eyes. So you can see how bright light would probably bother them because they have huge pupils and huge eyes that let in a lot of light. And so they don't, so presumably they also have fantastic night vision. Sunlight killing them in the exact manner that it kills them? I don't know. I would say on one hand that, you can say, okay, well, maybe ultraviolet light does something to them. But most of the time we see them being killed by sunlight in both movies, they're being killed by sunlight that's coming through a window. And the window would have filtered out all the ultraviolet light. So it's not the ultraviolet light, clearly, that's doing it. It's something else in the sunlight. And so it's hard to know exactly why sunlight would kill them and not any bright light that had the same spectrum as sunlight. I guess they never established that that's not what
happens. So yeah, I guess what the question would be, if I have a small flashlight on my keychain and I put it on Gizmo, it'll hurt him a little. Would a large flashlight hurt him more?
Well, there's a scene in the second movie where she takes a picture of somebody with a Polaroid camera and he instantly evaporates and there's a skeleton left behind.
Yeah.
So again, we can talk about this a bit more when we get there. I don't know how much to treat the second movie as canon, given how deliberately sort of silly and Looney Tunes-y it gets along the way. But
and it makes you wonder why they didn't use that device a little more. You know, like maybe if they had made a Gremlins 3, that would have been the point of get flash bulbs, and that would be just a good way to take them out.
Well, so there are places in the original movie where they do the exact same thing, and you know, obviously they don't like the bright light, but like there's that whole scene where she's in the bar and she uses the camera.
Yeah, the camera, they don't evaporate.
They don't dissolve, right? Exactly, they don't evaporate. They just, you know, they don't like it and they fall over or shy away or whatever. So it's a little unclear. I think it's science is a bit muddled on the point of how sunlight would kill them.
Can you talk a bit about photophobia in reality?
To be honest, I don't know a whole lot about it. I do know that there are people, and maybe this is it, I don't know. There are people who have a disorder where they can't sweat. And so being in sunlight is very, very bad for them because they can't get rid of the excess heat that their bodies are absorbing. Now, they don't melt, but they could overheat and get heat stroke and die. Presumably, Mogwai can't sweat, period. Because if they could just reproduce by sweating and then dripping on themselves. So maybe these two rules put together hint at some sort of biology.
There's got to be a good interview with Chris Columbus out there that just delves into all of this in a fun way.
Well, the beauty of it is, obviously, is that these rules, I mean, that's one of the things, that's one of the genius things about this movie, is that the rules are, they're so specific, but magical.
And I think one thing that's really funny and fun is, an audience likes it when you set up rules. Generally, movies don't set up their rules as clearly as on the poster, 1, 2, and 3. These are the rules. But they actually use – their rules are so integral to the plot that they actually use it as part of the marketing. But I think audiences and movie watchers like that when a movie sets up its rules and plays within them. And even if those rules kind of delve into the ridiculous, doesn't matter because within the realm of this world – within the world of this movie – those rules are established.
Well, I think that was, you know, a savvy decision on their part. Set up the rules. I think the minute you try to start explaining the rules, you know, which he, you know, parodies that in the second movie, and we'll get to that in a little bit on the as far as the third rule goes. But I think the fact that these rules are somewhat they are practical enough to make sense in the world of the movie. They are things that you can roll with. They're not like super esoteric, like, you know, like, oh, on the fourth moon of every third week on a Tuesday, you know, can't swing from a rafter with a clockwise whatever. Like, you know, they're simple, easy to explicate, easy to understand. And if you think about them too hard, they don't make any sense. But that, in a sense, is a strength. And the fact that they don't ever then delve into like, okay, well, how would this work? You know, in a sense, they don't do sort of what a lot of Star Trek fans do where, you know, Star Trek will talk about, you know, they'll have some gobbledygook explanation for reversing the polarity of blah, 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 blah. And there are people who will sit down and dissect for days. Okay, well, how does that relate to what they said in episode 327 where they said this thing and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that could be fun, I guess, in its own way. But at the end of the day, it's all gobbledygook. And so this movie just embraces it and says, all right, you know what? We're going to go with the gobbledygook. Doesn't make any sense. We don't care. Works.
All right. And we'll now get into my favorite of the three rules. Don't feed them after midnight. Steven, how many different ways can you come up with that this doesn't make sense?
I mean, they come up with at least three in the sequel itself.
All right. In Gremlins 2, they make two good points. What if you're on an airplane and you cross a time zone? And what if the gremlin eats something at 11 and then has a seed in his tooth and it comes out after midnight? Those are both great.
Yeah. Well, there's also, I mean, like if you eat something at 11:59 and it's still in your stomach digesting, does that count as having eaten it? How is that any different than just, is it the pack? Does it have to pass your esophagus after midnight? Or if it's, do you have something in your stomach after midnight? Is that what causes it? There's so many different ways.
And now we're getting into what constitutes eating.
Right.
Is it the chewing and swallowing or is it the
digestion? Right, exactly. You also then have what constitutes midnight, which is, you know, there's an astronomical answer to that question, which is, you know, noon is when the sun is at its highest point in your local, you know, at your specific longitude. And we have time zones, which are sort of a fiction that we invent to try to make timekeeping a little bit easier. But every single place on the Earth, every single line of longitude on the Earth has a different local midnight, a different local noon, and therefore a different local midnight. And so is it at local midnight or is it at clock midnight? It implies it's a clock midnight because there's a point where he looks over at the clock. And, you know, your time zone can be you know, even if it's not daylight saving times, which this isn't because it's Christmas, but even if it's not, your time zone can be off by as much as an hour from your true local midnight, depending on whether you're on the very east side of the time zone or the very west side of the time zone. Some time zones are not even close because of the way they have to draw the lines around population centers. You can be almost 2 hours off from where your actual sort of local midnight is. So which of those things actually counts? I am choosing to believe, because I'm a scientist, that it's your actual local midnight.
Yeah.
Because then there's at least some sort of scientific validity to it. If it's what your clock says based on a time zone, then that's garbage. That doesn't make any sense at all. But if it's where the sun is in relation to where your body, that also, in a sense, doesn't make any sense in the same way that, you know, astrology doesn't make any sense. But in a magical world, it makes a little bit more sense, because then it's okay, well, the sun is exactly opposite the earth from me, and maybe that does something to my molecules and blah, 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 blah. So I could go with that. And I also choose to believe that it's not a hard cutoff, that, you know, the likelihood of turning into a gremlin if a Mogwai eats after midnight is related to how late it eats. And so if it ate at 12:01, it might or might not become a gremlin. But so midnight is sort of like the safe cutoff. You know, like they say, you know, when they give an expiration date on food and they're like, oh, it goes bad on September 4th. Well, you know, there's no magical process that happens on September 4th. It might still be good on September 5th, but like September 4th is sort of the safe time to say, okay, you know what? It definitely won't go bad before then. Probably will go bad after that at some point. So just make sure you don't have it after September 4th. If you want a scientific explanation for gremlins, that's my guess.
Well, that also leads into one of my nitpicks, which makes no sense at all, but isn't every time of the day after midnight?
Well, so that's you're right. The other point is they don't ever say when the clock resets. Is it between midnight and 6 a.m.? Is it, you know, if they have to go to sleep and then when they wake up, they're fine and it has to be before midnight
the next
night?
4 p.m. is after midnight. It's also before midnight. I mean, it's...
Well, technically speaking, every time during a day is after midnight,
yes,
because midnight belongs to the day following it, not,
yes,
the day before it.
Correct.
So you can never have something that's before midnight. So, no. And again, if they had tried to explicate that, if they had tried to say like, oh, it's at, you know, 6 a.m. it resets or whatever.
Right, and you could see them. They had all the three rules, and the third rule was don't feed them between midnight and 3 a.m. local.
Yeah.
It's like, yo, Chris, we're going to fix this. It's don't feed them after midnight. Fine.
I mean, we know based on the clock in the science teacher's classroom that it's at least like 2:30 or so a.m. because that's when the one in his classroom eats and turns into...
Right. Can you talk a bit, science guy, about the metamorphosis stage of the gremlins and how could you compare it to an animal we might be more familiar with?
Well, obviously the most immediate comparison is to an insect. A butterfly is the one people mostly think of, but most insects go through some sort of metamorphosis. They start in some sort of larval stage. They build a cocoon or become a cocoon. And, you know, inside that cocoon, they metamorphize into their adult form and then they come out with wings and whatever else. There's no reason why a larger animal couldn't necessarily do that. The thing with these ones in particular, and it's the same problem with the reproduction, they have to build that cocoon out of something, right? It's matter. It exists. It's mass, you know. And those cocoons look like they probably contain at least as much mass, if not more, of the Mogwai itself.
No, yeah, it's a good point. If they had a camera running all night, what would it show? Where would the shell have come from? Did they spit it up out of their mouth?
Yeah, did they spit it up out of their mouth? And again, that shell looks like it probably contains at least as much matter as the original Mogwai did. So like eventually they would puke themselves to the point where they didn't exist anymore. And then they come out of that basically the same size as a Mogwai. In fact, probably even a little bit bigger. I think the gremlins are a bit bigger.
Yeah.
So, I mean, maybe that's why you can't feed them. Maybe they turned that chicken that they ate into, maybe they ate a lot more chicken than we noticed that they did.
Other highlights of this movie, I love that Flo from Alice, best known as the Kiss My Grits lady, plays the old woman who dies a horrible death at the hand of an electrically handy gremlin.
Well, so here we get into another really interesting scientific point that is compounded considerably in the sequel, but is still here in the original as well, which is how intelligent are Mogwai and gremlins relative to, you know, things that we are familiar with. They are clearly more intelligent than dogs. Right.
Yeah.
Dogs and cats more intelligent than most of the things that we would keep as pet animals.
I would say they're immediately second smartest to us. They can run machines. They can build tools. They can communicate. They're smarter than dolphins.
They understand irony.
Yup.
They somehow understand pop culture that existed for centuries before they did.
Yeah, they understand pop culture references that existed. These gremlins are literally 2 hours old. How do they know who Edward G. Robinson is? How do they know who Batman is?
How do they know who the Wizard of Oz is?
Yeah.
The Wicked Witch of the West.
Yup.
No, so clearly, I mean, they absorb a lot of TV. I don't know.
They're like a hive mind, maybe.
A hive mind.
They know what Mogwai knows. They know what Gizmo knows, maybe.
Well, so that's another interesting question, too, which is, in what sense is Gizmo responsible for these things? Or more to the point, like, does Gizmo have any sort of parental feelings for these offspring? He doesn't seem to at any point. He looks at them like, oh crap, these things just popped out of me, as opposed to like, you know, hey, these are my kids and they're kind of screwed up. But
no, he seems very rueful. He seems very dejected when they come out. Like
I guess he knows what they're capable of. And that's another question too that absolutely comes up, because when they pop out of him, both in the original and in the sequel, they are immediately mean and, you know, like you said, they're a little dumber than he is. They're clearly have a, you know, one-track mind, and they want to turn into gremlins. Like, that's clearly their goal. They trick Billy into feeding them after midnight.
So what is it that makes Gizmo intellectually superior?
Exactly. Like, was he trained by the old Chinese man to be a better man, a better Mogwai than his brethren? The other thing from a scientific point of view, which is really hammered home in the sequel, but true here as well, is given how fast these things reproduce and how devious they are and how intelligent they are, you have to assume that Gizmo is the last of his species. Because if there were any other ones anywhere, this disaster would have already happened. Like, they would have already overrun the entire world.
I was just going to say, how are they not more profligate? How are they not more common? If they reproduce, if anything, I mean, rabbits and cats reproduce real quick, and we see them everywhere. These things squirrels, make rabbits and cats look like, you know, whales and elephants. Right. I mean.
And again, they're also intelligent. Like, he goes to the swimming pool on purpose because he knows exactly what it's going to do. They deliberately make, you know, yank the cord of the clock so that he feeds them after midnight because they know exactly what it's going to do.
Yeah, that is clever.
But that brings up a whole host of interesting issues just from a psychological point of view, because Gizmo, we have decided, is fairly intelligent. Certainly at least as intelligent as something like a chimpanzee, probably as close to being as intelligent as a human being. Anyway, the point is if he is literally the last of his species, you'd think he would be sad about it, or, you know, that he would express some excitement when he reproduced, because he would no longer be alone. He would no longer be the only Mogwai in the world.
Wow. But
clearly, like you said, he has a lot of trepidation because he knows exactly what's going to happen. And so that's the tragedy, I guess, of Gizmo, is that he is doomed to be the only one of his species because he knows that the rest of his species will destroy the world if he allows them to exist.
And that is kind of a curse to know that you can reproduce at will, but anything you reproduce will be dangerous or stupid at best.
Will be literally a monster.
Awful.
Good luck enjoying this movie in the future, listeners.
Well, what are your takes just on the science angle of the microwave and the blender?
Well, the blender's not a blender. I always thought it was a blender. Like, in my brain, it was a blender, but it's not a blender. It's like...
Oh, it's the juicer. That's right. Thing. The juicer, right. My
bad. So who knows what the heck that thing is made out of? Who knows how it's, you know... One of the things I love, love, love about this movie is his inventions and how terrible they are and how they never work and how much confidence he still has in them and how, like, much of a hustler he is for, like, trying to go and sell these things. And he sells the guy the smoke ashtray and he comes out and he's, like, coughing like crazy and can barely breathe. Like, I love all of that stuff with Hoyt Axton for that reason.
The bathroom buddy.
But they stick him in this juicer thing. It blends him up. I mean, that seems reasonable to me. The microwave seems a little less reasonable to me, right? If only for the fact that, like, you put animal carcasses in your microwave all the time. You call it food, right? Very rarely does it explode. Sometimes it does. If you stuck an egg in a microwave, it would explode.
Was that Gremlin not holding a knife?
Is he?
I thought the Gremlin had a weapon.
So. I don't know. I don't really remember. I wasn't paying
that attention. So not that anybody should check, but if you were to put a living animal in a microwave, it would kill it.
Just cook it.
Yeah, it would.
Yeah, I would just cook it from the inside out, and then you'd have cooked animal.
Like, I always thought that the reason that something like that would explode in a blender or in a microwave is because it had like there was a lot of hollow areas in the animal. And then,
well, it's possible. Yes. I mean, in the way that microwave popcorn explodes, right? If you have something containing water, so a microwave works by making the water molecules rotate really, really fast, which heats them up. And so, you know, like for instance, in a kernel of popcorn, you have this starchy stuff and you have a little bit of moisture in there. And when the water makes that moisture hot, it starts expanding and expanding, but it can't because that shell is holding it in until such a point where the pressure inside becomes so great that it explodes that shell, and then boom, it puffs into popcorn. So, you know, maybe there is some sort of water-filled cavity inside of a gremlin that contains that reaction until such a point as the pressure builds up so much that it explodes. I suppose I don't know how they shot that effect. It looks like they actually exploded something. I don't think it was probably in a microwave, or in a working microwave.
No,
but
of course not,
they clearly exploded something in there. So,
just for the sake of completion, can you explain the science behind a smokeless ashtray?
I don't think Rand Pelzer could either, so I'm not going to even try.
Well, I assume it works somewhat like a vacuum cleaner.
It looks like it works like it's literally just a dome covering your ashtray, and when you close it when you're smoking the cigarette.
No, but there are smokeless ashtrays in the world, Stephen. There are ones out there.
I have never encountered one.
Oh, okay. Well, they have like little vacuums in them, and obviously, I guess there's filters
some sort
in
of filter.
There. Yeah, and you got to clean, empty the filter, whatever. All right. Can you talk about how upsetting it is to see that dog hung up in the Christmas lights, and how did they do it?
Oh, I have no idea how they did it. That's an interesting question.
I guess they would kind of wrap it around the dog and then just yank it up as if you were hanging someone, maybe, you know, like.
No, I mean, I don't think they would have gotten away with actually hanging a dog. So they had to, it must have been supported in some way.
No, I'm saying how did the gremlins get it up there?
Oh, I don't know how the gremlins got it up there. Immediately after that scene, they talk about how he talks about how he's pretty sure he locked the door. I don't know how the gremlins got up to unlock the door to get out there in the first place. So the gremlins do a lot of things that it's hard to imagine how they did.
But in their defense, they are gremlins, and that is kind of what they do. But let's talk about one thing, and this I want to talk to you, not necessarily entertainment value and not necessarily science. I want to talk to you about screenwriting, Stephen. And for the last several years, people who love Gremlins or dislike it, I don't know anyone who dislikes it, but you run across anything and they'll still kind of make fun of the monologue that Phoebe Cates has about how her father passed away. Do you think that's good screenwriting or bad? And I think that my opinion has changed over the years, but I want to hear what you say first.
Oh, it is unequivocally the best moment of the entire movie and one of the greatest moments in cinema history. I think that anybody that says they want to take that out, which includes Steven Spielberg and the studio, I'm glad Joe Dante stuck to his guns, because that is the perfect example to me of the tonal line that this movie rides so, so well, because it is simultaneously really, really, really dark and grim and awful and hilarious at the same time.
Yep.
And how it manages to do that, it, just that sort of jaw on the floor, like, I cannot believe she's telling this story. I cannot believe they're stopping this movie in the middle of this to have her tell this awful, awful story and getting away with it. And partly it's her performance and his reaction to it. I think everything about that scene works. And it's my favorite scene in the movie and one of my favorite scenes of all time.
If you had asked me when I was a know-it-all 20-something-year-old, I would have said, it just doesn't feel like it belongs. It feels like it belongs in like a dark, much darker movie. It just feels like it belongs in a different film. And now, having watched it a few weeks ago, I like it a lot more. I do think that Joe Dante knows what he's doing. The people who would say it's too dark or it doesn't belong or it's cornball writing, I don't think they're getting
the tone of the movie.
Yeah, I don't like to say it that way. I don't like to say people are not getting if they don't, you know what I mean? Like, how do I know what they're getting?
Well, I think that they're missing something essential about the DNA of this movie. And I think there's a weird sort of amnesia that has to happen in order for that to happen, because this is a movie where, I mean, the last 10 minutes of this movie are tense and scary. He gets shot in the arm with a crossbow. Stripe is literally shooting at him with a revolver, and you kind of feel like he might actually hit him because it feels genuinely dangerous. And then it ends with this gruesome, gruesome transformation scene when the sunlight hits him and he starts to melt. You know, it makes Tote and the rest of the Raiders of the Lost Ark effects look positively Disney in comparison, just how gruesome and just like, and it goes on and on and on. And there's so many moments like that. The whole, that whole scene in the kitchen with the mother where she sticks him in the juicer and puts him in the, like, that's another really tense, scary scene where you genuinely feel like she's in danger. And,
When they mess with the Futtermans, because you like Dick Miller so much, you're like, he is a tertiary character. He could die, you know, and, you know, it does feel like a horror movie. And then for 5-10 minutes, it feels like a comedy. And then some scenes, it feels like both. And I really do think that her monologue about her dead father is meant to be both, like, fascinating and sad and darkly funny.
Like, oh, it's so funny. Yeah, yeah. It's hilarious.
And in, so far in, as to go, that they, Joe Dante made sure that his new screenwriter on Gremlins 2 had Phoebe Cates do a semi-parody of that sequence, and they cut her off halfway through. So it's not like he didn't hear the complaints or the comments about that moment. So
it only works because of that. I mean, that's the great thing about that second movie, right? So, which maybe, you know, now it's time to, for us to sort of transition.
Yeah, I think it's a good way to switch over. Let's just do this. On a 5-star scale, what would you give Gremlins?
5. Easily. It's one of the best movies ever made.
All right. I'm with you. As a longtime film critic, I am very, very hesitant to give out 5s because then...
Oh, I am too.
You're kind of on the record as like, this is an all-time great. And
this is an all-time great. And it has stood the test of time.
And I'm like, and then you start thinking about, well, would you put Gremlins up against Casablanca or There Will Be Blood or, you know, stuff like that? And it doesn't matter. You could take it either for what it is or just as an entertaining movie. It's 5 stars. I absolutely love it. Love it. Love it. And let's move on. Gremlins 2. Steven saw it as a kid?
Yeah, I saw that one in the theater.
Okay.
And I was, 13. It was 1990. So yeah, I would have been 13 years old. I definitely remember going to see that. I definitely remember loving the shit out of it. Rewatching it again now, and I've probably only seen it a handful of times since then. Rewatching it again now, it is a very, very fun movie. Rewatching it immediately after the first one, there is a stark contrast between its ambitions, right? So beginning with the opening Looney Tunes cartoon thing, Joe Dante is declaring, look, this is not a horror comedy. This is just going to be a comedy. And a goofy one at that. And I'm fine with that. It's almost a parody of the original Gremlins in a sense. Like, it almost feels like a Zucker Brothers or Mel Brooks sort of send up in a lot of places of the original Gremlins. And I think it works for what it is. I think it does not capture the magic of that amazing, amazing tonal mishmash that the original is. But it's a very fun movie.
I like it very much. If you had asked me when I was younger, I probably would have said Gremlins 2 is slightly better just because as a 14, 15, 16, whatever it was, a year old, actually he's 90, I would have been. Yeah, I just, when you're younger, I think you're more attuned to chaos and it doesn't have to work together as a 3-act structure so much with believable characters. It can be just wacky and consistently fun, and that's great. And I think as I've grown older, I was like, nah, I definitely, I can do the star rating now. If I give Gremlins a 5, this is a 4.25. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, it's a 3 for me. It's a solid movie, but it isn't, it doesn't, Gremlins, I mean, let's put it this way. It is not the kind of movie that is so unique that it requires a brand new ratings classification from the MPAA because it's that unclassifiable.
The point.
It is not groundbreaking in that way. It's just a fun, goofy, silly comedy. It's not in any point scary or tense at all because it leans so heavily on the comedy that it never has a chance to actually be scary at any point.
If you want to talk structure, Gremlins is, of course, a comedic horror film or with sci-fi, of course. But I think Gremlins 2 plays like a parody of disaster movies where everybody's stuck in a building and there's a fire or a flood or something invading the building. But beyond that, it's very flimsy plot-wise. It really is almost anthology style in which it's like, hey, Gremlins in a high-tech, computerized building that has a TV studio and a genetics lab and apartments, a golf course and a food court. And it's like, okay, so just everything you need to be in your movie. Like, I don't, you know, what's the logic of having a genetic?
Well, I mean, I can tell you that part of that comes from the fact that they originally wanted it to take place just in New York. And the studio decided that that would be way too difficult to shoot and cost way too much money. So they sort of pared it down and said, all right, well, let's just do it all in this one office tower instead. And so I think when they did that, they decided, all right, well, we got to, you know, we have already thought of all of these set pieces that we want to be in the movie. So we're just going to have to, you know, there's got to be a yogurt shop.
Right. And if you want to talk about just pure writing, whether you're making a comedic horror film or a broad farce that satirizes basically all sequels, you still have to strain credibility. The way that Billy Peltzer and Gizmo reacquaint in this movie,
yeah,
it makes no sense.
No. Well, see, again, I think that it works in this movie because of this Looney Tunes sort of tone. Like you immediately just have to like go with all of it, right? If you tried to do a similar tone to the first movie in this movie, all of these things that make no sense would become immediately apparent. You know, things like, right, so the way that he encounters, so Billy is now working in this office tower that's owned by Clamp, is that his name?
Yes, Daniel Clamp, as played by the brilliant, brilliant John Glover. And I think it's a clear, I don't think it definitely is a clear parody of Trump combined with Ted Turner. And although yeah. I think that John Glover and Dante choose to play him a bit too wide-eyed and innocent to really get the kind of parody we would like, I do think that
certainly in 2019.
Yeah, I just think if you just take him as just a broad character, I think John Glover does some really funny work.
I think he's great. Yep. I think he's great. I think he rides that line between, because you expect him to be the villain of the movie.
Yes.
And he turns out not to be. He turns out to actually be sort of somewhat heroic, but still very, very selfish. And I think they nailed his character in the best way possible for this movie.
Yep.
But anyway, so Billy and Katie, Phoebe Cates and
Zach Galligan
now work in this office building for his company. And separately, elsewhere in this office building, there is a genetics laboratory. And this scientist who works in the genetics laboratory happens to be wandering around Chinatown, which they never established where this is where the original takes place.
The beginning of this movie feels like it was reshot at the last minute. And then once the first 15 minutes are really clunky, but then once the gremlins are established in the building, that's when the fun really starts.
Yeah. Well, so I'm asking this as much as, you know, commenting on it, like the town in which the first one takes place, is there any indication where, like what part of the country that's in, what its proximity to New York is?
I don't believe Kingston Falls is ever specified in a state. Let's say Pennsylvania.
It's got to be close enough that this guy, scientist who works in this building in New York, is able to go to whichever Chinatown the Mogwai lives in, where the old man's store is, and finds Gizmo there and takes him back within a few hours. So I guess that Chinatown is supposed to be the Chinatown in Manhattan, I imagine, which means Rockford Falls or whatever it is must be somewhere nearby. But anyway, regardless, the point is Gizmo ends up in this lab, which is a weird enough coincidence. But then to add on top of that, the way that Billy actually finds out that he's there is that a messenger who is played by the future Tuco Salamanca from Breaking Bad, incidentally, is dropping off a package and hears Gizmo whistling his sort of signature tune, and then he starts whistling it himself when he's dropping something off near Billy's desk, and Billy's like, where did you hear that song?
Yeah, see, all of this feels rushed and like thought up at the last minute, all of it. It really does. And I'm not, doesn't ruin the movie for me, but you know, if you're trying to just set up even the flimsiest of stories, you know, this is like Gilligan's
Island.
Which
is fine.
Stuff.
Again, right. Again, this whole thing feels like, that is not the least plausible thing in this movie by it. Any stretch. So, like.
Well, no, but you know, we talk about this a lot. There's a big difference between scientific implausibility, which can be very forgiven, and then just structural or internal.
Yeah, but again, this movie is so, it's, you know, it's like taking.
So then it can be forgiven anything, right? Because of the tone, it can be forgiven anything.
I think, honestly, this movie could be forgiven pretty much anything in the same way that you don't wonder, like, why are all these people slapping that woman and getting away with it in Airplane? Because, like, it's clearly in a world that's just that ridiculous.
All right. Well, see, yeah, there's our disconnect. I don't think it's – yeah. All right. Fair enough. My problem is I think that Gremlins 2 is meant to take place in a real world, and you think it's a pure farce in a made-up, like, alternate reality, and that's totally legit.
The camera, I mean, a character's literally turn and wink at the camera at points. Like, there's that whole sequence in the middle where Hulk Hogan yells at the Gremlins in the theater that you're watching it in. Like, and again, I don't think it's an accident at all that he begins with literally with the Looney Tunes logo and Daffy Duck chiding Bugs Bunny.
And by the way, if you enjoy that little abbreviated Looney Tunes logo at the set up at the beginning, be sure to watch through the end credits.
I mean, at one point, so here's an example of sort of the kind of silliness that I'm talking about. And it's a very small example, but I think it's very illustrative. His boss takes him out, his female boss takes him out to a restaurant. She's trying to seduce him. And the restaurant that she takes him to, what kind of restaurant is it?
Canadian.
It's a Canadian restaurant. Like, there's no, like, that to me is that's a joke. That's the kind of joke that you could absolutely see in a Zucker Brothers movie. They offer him Molson. The waiters are all dressed like Mounties and they're serving Canadian food. Who the hell knows what the Canadian food is?
Dude, it's poutine is Canadian food. I want to throw out a little bit of love. His lady boss is played by Haviland Morris. And I did a quick check because she's strikingly pretty in the movie and very funny. And I was like, I've seen her in two or three things. What do I know her from? And I discovered two things. One, she's Molly Ringwald's big sister in 16 Candles. And she has that great bit at the end where she gets wasted on painkillers, I believe, at her wedding and is just tripping throughout her own wedding. And she's very funny in this. And she did a lot of TV after this and never really did many big movies after this. But Haviland Morris, like, really vamping it up as the femme fatale, like, lady snake boss who wants to seduce our hero, maybe. And she's very funny.
And there's no villains in this movie. That's one of the things that about it. Like, again, you could have had John Glover, could have very easily been a villain. Even Robert Picardo, who is, you know, clearly also sort of portrayed as, oh, he's going to be the villain of the thing, ends up not being that villainous. She, you think, might be the villain. She's not the villain. Obviously, the Gremlins are the villain, but there's no sort of human antagonist in this that you would expect. Even from, like you said, like disaster movies that it's parodying, there's almost always some human villain that you're waiting to see die by the end of the movie.
Yep.
And everybody in this movie has something, you know, Christopher Lee.
Oh, again, I was hoping, I was scientist. Waiting, damn it. I was waiting for you to stop because I said, oh, there's one more who looks like he'll be the villain, but isn't.
Yep. And so they all get their moments of redemption and they all, you know, by the time the Gremlins all bust out, there are no real human villains. It's just everybody against the Gremlins. And, you know, it's very good natured in that way. There's no character that may, like the old woman in the original, where you're like, I can't wait to see this woman die.
Or, oh, and we never did mention Judge Reinhold in the first one, who is a fun rival for Billy.
Yeah, but he doesn't, I can't even remember what happens to him. He just feels like he just disappears from the movie and then he's just not in it anymore.
He does. Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned this because it's not in my notes. Holy crap. I'm not going to spoil it, but if anybody wants to know what happens to the Judge Reinhold character in Gremlins, read the novelization because it's in there. Bam.
Okay.
Yeah.
He just disappears at one point and then we never see him again.
One of the things I love about Joe Dante is that he is loyal to his regulars. Henry Gibson has a quick bit in this as a guy who's fired for smoking. I guess Henry Gibson was busy with something else because he gets bigger parts in other Joe Dante movies. Interesting tidbit, Belinda Blasky, who Joe Dante hired often, she's also in the first movie as the broke mom who needs help from the nasty old lady. And in this one, yep, she plays a mother who's in the movie theater.
Her character never goes anywhere in the first one either. Like, nope. She's in a couple of introductory scenes, but then we never have any closure on her character at all. You know who else is in the original that we just talked about the other day?
Go.
Jonathan Banks.
Oh, yeah, he is very quickly.
Plays a deputy.
Yep.
Much younger Jonathan Banks.
I had to feel a little bit of empathy and sympathy for the great Getty Watanabe, who starred in a lot of movies throughout the 80s, and sometimes he was just, you know, asked to just play.
Just be the walking Asian stereotype.
Yeah, and in this one he is, you know, unfortunately saddled with this. An Asian man is nothing but a tripod for a camera. That's the joke.
Yep.
And, you know, I don't think that, I don't believe that Joe Dante has a prejudice bone in his body. I think this is one long, lingering, ugly stereotype that was, you know, lots of stereotypes died out in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. And this is one that still hasn't completely died out, but thankfully has died out a lot.
Yeah, you definitely would not be able to get away with that character in a movie in 2019.
He also played Long Duk Dong, who is, you know, and it's easy to see when you watch 16 Candles how ridiculously talented the guy is with physical comedy. But yeah, I don't blame. I blame the culture of the time. I don't blame anybody who made the movie. It's just the way things were.
Although he was playing a similar sort of stereotype in UHF, and there, because of the broadness of the movie, I feel like it kind of worked.
Yep.
In a way that I still don't think you would do in a movie in 2019, but it doesn't read to me as offensive as his portrayal in this movie or as Long Duk Dong, for sure.
And I'm sure you read, I read in passing that there was a subplot with Robert Prosky, the great late character actor who plays the Grandpa Fred, the horror movie host, who is clearly an homage to Grandpa from...
So much of an homage that I'm surprised they didn't get sued, because he literally, like, I thought for years... In fact, I thought until I did the research this afternoon that was the guy that played Grandpa Munster.
Oh, you thought that was Al Lewis? No, it's the great Robert Prosky, who's in Christine and The Natural. And you know him. You've seen him in 100 movies, Robert Prosky.
To be fair, I've never seen an episode of The Munsters, so I only know them from, you know, bits and pieces of pop culture and whatnot. But
it is a lot of fun. Let's get into the science of Stephen. Could there be a vegetable gremlin in real life?
All right, so let's talk about that whole sequence, right? And this is where I'm talking about sort of the implausibility of this whole thing. So a bunch of gremlins breaks back into this genetics lab and discovers a bunch of very conveniently labeled vials that just have images on them of what they will do to the gremlin.
One is an electrical bolt. One is a big spider.
One is a sun with a circle around it and a slash through it. That's genetic sunblock.
I think the setup for this movie is a bit clunky, but still entertaining. From this point on, I'm in. Yeah. I like all of it.
Well, there's that really funny sketch from Key and Peele. I don't know if you've seen where... They fake the pitch for this movie and the electric. Yeah, so a bunch of gremlins drink various of these potions, and one of them turns into a spider, one of them turns into a bat, and then one of them, you know, drinks one that has a brain on it and apparently has brain hormone, which not only makes him really, really smart, it also somehow makes him grow glasses.
and teaches him English instantly.
And he becomes very articulate.
As voiced by, we got to throw in some love. That was Tony Randall, voicing the brain gremlin. And Tony Randall, everybody knows from The Odd Couple and just legend.
Who has this weird sort of hybrid Australian-English accent that's kind of not either.
Yep.
So anyway, yes, so this brainiac gremlin now also decides that he's going to take the bat gremlin and inject him with this genetic sunscreen so that he can go out into the world. He doesn't ever think to inject himself with the genetic sunscreen so that he can just go outside. So he's not that smart.
Well, maybe they're sending him out like a scout to see if it works.
Right, but the point is he has this genetic sunblock, like, and he sends him out and it works. So why didn't he ever inject himself? Or, you know, there was clearly a whole lot of it. He just kind of forgets that it's there by the end of the movie and just decides to go down into the lobby and wait for nighttime, like with everybody else. He's not as smart as he thinks he is. There's a great, great, great moment with him later on in the movie where Grandpa Munster is interviewing him on television, and he's talking about how gremlins only want civilization and whatever else, and he shoots the other gremlin in the face. And so you get this juxtaposition of like, yes, I'm super, super smart, but I'm still a gremlin and I still do mean, nasty, vicious things like shoot my fellow gremlins in the face.
That might be my favorite gag in the whole movie. And you failed to mention my very favorite gremlin, the mutant gremlin.
Which one is that?
The Electro Gremlin.
We mentioned him, but tell me more.
I think he's got cool powers. He can jump between.
He does have cool powers. I had forgotten that he became the sort of deus ex machina, not really deus ex machina, but the machina, at least, through which the denouement is achieved. For some reason, I remembered, like, I literally, in my brain, they pulled the curtains up and the sunlight flooded the lobby and they all died that way. But that's not what happens. So the plan that they devise, Zach Galligan and these other people, decide to move all the clocks forward because as smart as these gremlins are, apparently they're not that smart. Or they don't have a very good internal clock, I guess. And so if they move the clocks forward 3 hours, the gremlins will think that the sun has gone down. They'll gather in the lobby to go out into the city. And then they'll, you know, meanwhile, they've hung these big things outside the building so that they don't realize that the sun is still out and they're going to lift them up. But of course, a storm rolls in right at that exact moment. And so not only is it now dark outside, but it's also raining. And so if these gremlins go out now, it's definitely going to be bad. Meanwhile, he has somehow trapped the electric gremlin in the telephone system because that's the rules.
Dude, it makes perfect sense. He put him on hold. What do you want?
See, but this is precisely what I mean about how the original has these three rules, and the rules themselves, if you nitpick them, are ridiculous, but it sticks to them religiously and it commits to them in a way that's like, we are going to treat this as if it is reality. And in this movie, like, okay, well, the electric gremlin can get trapped. Well, first of all, a gremlin can turn into pure electricity by injecting itself with potion. And then it can be trapped in the phone system. And then he can somehow intuit that you can let the thing out of the phone system by taking it off of hold. Meanwhile, he has somebody spray all of the gremlins with water, which potentially, obviously, could be a complete disaster because now they're going to start multiplying again. But then he six the electric gremlin on them, and in the process, it kills the electric gremlin as well because he never comes back. So,
and there's also another mutant gremlin that we haven't touched on, and I find it a bit problematic. It touches back to our Gizmo question of what gender is Gizmo. Apparently, right. In the world of gremlins, female is an exotic mutation, and you come out looking like Veronica Lake gremlin from 1946.
Yeah. To be fair, it is very, very clear throughout both of these movies that the gremlins have nothing but male energy. You can't, I mean, like, let's be honest about our own gender here, right? Men are a destructive force.
Yeah. No, every gremlin is virtually some variation of a 7-year-old boy.
Exactly. They are, as you know, for all of, you know, talks about nature versus nurture, whatever else, anybody who has kids will tell you, boys from their earliest age, and we socialize a lot of this into them and we reinforce it and whatever else, and there's toxic masculinity and blah, blah, blah. But from a very early age, there is a difference between boys and girls, and boys have an energy to them that is considerably more destructive oftentimes than their female counterparts, and they mature less fast. And so, yeah, you're right. It's just this army of 7-year-old boys. So I think it's fair to say that all of the gremlins are male. But yes, it is sort of a weird, like, okay, well, now we're going to have this female.
I could see him sitting around the room and going, all right, we need 8 mutant gremlins for this whole sequence. And like, Electro, Spider, Vegetable, Bat, Sunscreen, Female.
Like, weird mutation.
What?
Woman.
Because it just opens up all other kinds of questions. We've never seen any evidence of a female before, although...
Well, they don't need females because they don't need to reproduce sexually. So, like, you know, that would be the primary reason for having two different genders in a species is because you have to get them together in order to reproduce. Since these guys can reproduce asexually, they don't need females. They only need one gender, whatever it is. And, you know, even if you want to say it's not male, it's just gremlin. They're gremlin gender.
All right, let's end up with this, Steven. If you and I were, by some magical gift of fate, hired to write a Gremlins 3, where would we set it? I have a very good idea, but I want you to answer first.
In space.
In space is great. I got one. On a cruise ship.
Yeah, you can't. How could you do that, though? Literally, all they'd have to do is jump off the side of the ship, and there'd be an infinite number of them.
Yep. That would be the threat. That would be the threat throughout, I suppose. And we'd have, like, I've always wanted to write a horror movie that it entirely takes place in a cruise ship. And that would
you'd have to find some way to confine them to the lower decks.
Yes. That would be the point decks. Is that part of the joke would be, oh, well, they can just get out onto the deck and jump in the water. But part of the ongoing joke of the movie is that the ship is so ridiculously large. It's like a hotel and a mall combined that they can't find their way out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So although the film does take place in a complete alternate, wonderful fantasy world, there must be other science points that you'd like to delve into for Gremlins 2, The New Batch, Steven.
Well, so there's two. One of them harkens back to the first film more so than this one. We talked about sort of water and what forms of water will make these things multiply. The entire first movie takes place in snow, which is, Scott, as you learned in elementary school, what?
Frozen rain.
Frozen water. Yes. So at one point they're Christmas caroling outside for the old lady and don't seem to be multiplying. So I guess it has to be liquid water, but then why can't they just like melt the snow in their hands and then use that to reduce?
God,
could
you imagine if Neil deGrasse Tyson got a hold of this movie? Good Lord.
And then the only other scientific thing from the second movie, there's a scene where Phoebe Cates gets trapped in an elevator and the gremlins are controlling the elevator. And first they shoot her up way up to the top of the building. And then some gremlins start attacking her inside the elevator. And then another gremlin sends the elevator car plummeting like 100 stories to the bottom of the elevator shaft. And somehow or another, the thing lands at the bottom of the elevator shaft. All of the gremlins get turned into goop because they would, because they just basically fell 100 stories and then were abruptly, you know, it's the equivalent to just jumping off a 100-story building. The fact that they were in the elevator and the elevator was free-falling doesn't save them from that. But somehow or another, Phoebe Cates doesn't have a scratch.
But she held on to something and they didn't. No, obviously.
She jumped at the last
minute. She jumped at the very late. We already talked about that on an episode, didn't we?
So, yeah, so that was the only other sort of scientific point.
I'll ask you this. If Mogwai existed in the real world, Stephen, what would happen?
I mean, we would all be dead within a matter of days. Clearly, if these movies show anything, it's that, like, only by the skin of their teeth do they manage to avert a global pandemic of gremlins reproducing at an exponential rate and destroying everything.
Well, I want to thank everybody for listening. This was a lot of fun. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, happy New Year, happy Hanukkah and Kwanzaa, happy weekend, happy birthday, if you happen to have a birthday in the coming weeks, as I do. And we want to thank you for listening to Science versus Fiction. This was a really fun one.
Thank you guys for listening. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, and we'll see you next time.
Hey, all, thanks for listening. We really hope you enjoyed Science versus Fiction. Hey, Stephen, you know what people can do if they want to support the show?
No, Scott, why don't you tell me what people can do if they want to support the show?
Well, there are many several awesome things that you could do. Leave us a review at iTunes, or tweet about us, or Facebook about us, or email your mom and tell her that this is the best podcast ever. You could also sign up for our Patreon account, which will give you bonus episodes like commentaries, interviews, and random fun stuff for nerds. So thanks for listening.